This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Good to be with you today. We are jam-packed with goodness. Jack Rice is going to join us. Obviously, we'll talk about the trial of the three other officers involved in the George Floyd killing. That will come up here in the 5 o'clock hour. A lot to get to with the Minnesota coronavirus update. We got to talk about, hey, Packer fans, bet you're feeling down. Anyway, we'll get to that a little bit later on. But our Democrat of the day represents District 59A. He is Representative Fooley. He's kind enough to join us today to talk about his the current session he is in, as well as his reelection campaign coming up here in November. Representative, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
My absolute pleasure. You reminded me, we talked, I think it was a while back that we actually chatted. You were Democrat of the day before. You've definitely made a predominant name for yourself within the Minnesota House there. A lot of people look up to you and point to you for some of the bills you've been putting forward, some of the ideas that you're putting out there. Definitely, a nice breath of fresh air for the DFL. Nicely done.
Thank you for that. You know, it takes a lot of hard work and, you know, support from listeners like you have on the show to get to where I'm at today.
I'm going to start off with something that really just, I know it makes me upset, and I live in Hopkins. If it makes me upset, I know it's going to make you upset. Let's talk a little bit, first of all. Your district basically runs the river to the Memorial Parkway over there from Broadway North and the North Minneapolis area. You have basically become enemy number one of the state because of Republicans. They have no problem in throwing specifically not only the city of Minneapolis, but your district specifically under the bus to basically vilify anything to do with the cities, anything to do with ethnicity, anything to do with equality. It's got to be infuriating to constantly have Republicans, especially Republicans who have never spent a single moment in your district, use your district to vilify their perceived enemies.
It is tough to, you know, be the number one target for a lot of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, especially now, you know, with some of the issues that we're seeing around gun violence, public safety. They're saying that, you know, what's happening in Minneapolis is going to happen statewide, and we know that that's not true, where a lot of these issues that we are seeing in the city of Minneapolis is happening, you know, nationally too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also pointed out over the holidays, I said, you know, these guys like to vilify Minneapolis, and there are problems in Minneapolis. We're not going to candy coat it. But at the same time, you take a look at, you know, driving deaths outstate Minnesota, dramatically higher this last year. Drunken driving deaths, dramatically higher. The meth crisis in rural America. They're ignoring the real problems in their own districts to create a mythical boogeyman that they can basically vilify by going after your district. And that's the part. I mean, it's not only vilifying you and your district, it's completely ignoring their own problems within their own districts.
Exactly. They're just doing this to, you know, to pander to, you know, the far right so that they could actually just try to scare people and, you know, really get into the fears of people. And I don't think that that's right. You know, as elected officials, you know, for us, we really need to see what can we do to help out Minnesotans and not, you know, to harp on the fears that people have because of what, you know, it's out there with the media and whatnot.
Since we are pretty close to the beginning of the year, let's talk about last year. What are some of the things that you felt worked well for you in the House last year?
You know, last year, I'm glad that we had a lot of our people of color members as chairs of the different committees in the House. And so we really look at, you know, some of the legislation and some of the budgets that we passed through a race equity lens. How do we ensure that all Minnesotans are going to benefit from our budgets? And I think that, you know, from public safety to education, we made significant investment with our state dollars, and that's what I'm looking forward to this upcoming year. How could we double down on what we were able to achieve for racial equity in the state of Minnesota?
The, you know, once you, we have clearly problems with racial equity, we need to address these issues. It is also difficult as the House, which has put forward some great legislation, you run up against the Senate as well. That, you know, that they're, you know, as they said, they're driving a narrative. And even though you have the governor on your side trying to help you out, you got two of the three working together. The Senate still is, you know, takes pride in trying to derail issues like that.
You know, you are right. And, you know, what the Senate Republicans want to prioritize this year is tax cut for the rich. And in order for them to get any kind of proposal and carry through on, you know, what they're promising for their big donors, they need to work with us in the House and also the administration. And we have seen, you know, at least with capital investment and what I have jurisdiction over, the governor is doubling down on racial equity. And that's what we're going to do, too, as we move along the process. And, you know, the Senate GOP will have to work with us in order to get what they would want to prioritize this upcoming legislative session.
You are looking at this upcoming year here before we get into the election. What are some of your priorities as far as bills, not only for the state of Minnesota, because obviously you are in many different committees. You're chair of the Capital Investment Committee and, you know, as well as others. You're a member of others. Let's talk about some of the statewide issues, but also let's talk about some things you want to champion for 59A specifically.
You know, for my district in North Minneapolis, having represented the riverfront, I think that we need to do more around some of the environmental concerns that we are seeing with regards to the air that we're breathing in North Minneapolis and the water quality. We need to make sure that, you know, big corporations, though that are existing right now in North Minneapolis or those that are proposing to come in, that they actually, you know, really let the state know how they are, you know, impacting our air and water so that we can make sure that our, you know, public health agencies are aware of what's going on, and we protect public health over corporate interests.
One of the things I find interesting about that issue is you're in a part of the metro which has got, you know, some older buildings, some older industrial areas, which, you know, because of what was going on back when those businesses were there, they're not the most environmentally safe zones. Obviously, you've got an important area in a great location that you can easily upgrade, give someone a fantastic location just north of the downtown, right on the river there. But there's a lot of people that won't go in and develop some of these properties because of the economic cleanup elements of it, that the feeling is that if it's going to cost me that much to clean it up, I'll just go find someplace else to do it. I mean, are we working on some sort of incentives? I mean, once again, I'm talking about people that are buying established lots and stuff like that, stuff that they themselves did not pollute. Are we working on some avenues here to help basically clean up some of these sites?
You know, right now, that hasn't really been something that we've been looking at. But I would say this, you are right that we have some pretty good land up by my area, just north of downtown. And, you know, that's what we were able to achieve, you know, from when I first had a conversation with you in 2018 until 2020. We got some significant dollars coming in from the state to redevelop the Upper Harbor Terminal area. You know, that's going to bring in a performance art venue, mm-hmm. and, you know, some private space so that, you know, residents on the north side, if they want to participate in economic development, that they have the ability to do so. And I'm starting to see that, you know, if the state is willing to invest in areas like mine, economic development is going to follow.
Well, it can't help but follow. It's such a great location. I mean, it really is a gem. I actually, one of the things I love about your district is the amount of public art that's out there. I don't know who's behind all the great art, whether it's just the paintings on side of buildings, some of the art pieces that are on display. It is really magnificent. Someone's done a fantastic job in your district because it's one of the best ones for art I've ever seen.
It is, and I think, you know, that's just prioritizing and bringing in residents and, you know, showing residents, you know, those artists or young families that, you know, we are welcoming them into our area so that they could actually, you know, start and develop a life there. And, you know, that's going to be what it takes, you know, for us to address some of the issues that we're seeing with regards to, you know, public safety and gun violence. We have to come together as a city and as a state to show that, you know, we care about each other and that we're going to do what we can to make North Minneapolis a place where everyone will come in and will like to come in and live.
The when you talk about the violence, one of the things that's interesting, and I saw the story, this is not in your district, but down by Williams in Uptown, they had the issue down there. And the first thing I said when I saw that is, okay, I've been to Uptown a lot of times. There used to be a lot of police down there. No one would have ever thought of doing something so brazen before. And it just feels like there's a detachment by the Minneapolis police to the policing element of it. I'm not saying that there aren't a lot of people out there working hard. I'm not saying there aren't a lot of great cops. There are. But there just definitely seems that ever since George Floyd, there seems to be this mentality that at least the perception I get is that unless, you know, we're so upset about how things ended with Chauvin and the rest of this that, you know, it basically, you know, we're not going to do the policing like we used to do. And henceforth, it sends a signal to the criminal element that there is opportunity there. Have you talked about that? I mean, my perception, I know, is a perception. But at the same time, we do have those issues out there. And it does feel like I hear a lot of people talk about, I've called the police. They said they'll be there in 4 hours. I mean, that's not exactly a responsive police department.
I don't think so, too. And, you know, for me personally, living on the north side, I've experienced that myself over this. Past fall, the last few months, there's been a few gun violence incidents just around the house or outside my bedroom window, what we call the cops. And, you know, maybe 30 an hour, they'll come by. And I think that, you know, that's not the right way to go. And for me, you know, at the state, really pushing for a comprehensive approach to public safety. I know that in talking with my neighbors, I think trauma is real. And we need to address the trauma that's associated with gun violence, whether, you know, you're a victim, a perpetrator, or just, you know, a neighbor that, you know, happens to live in an area that has a lot gun violence, so that, you know, we could actually provide the mental health and the resources for community members to address, you know, what's going on in their daily life so that they could at least try to be as productive as they can without, you know, having to be fearful of gun violence.
And well, let's be honest, the Republican mentality of guns everywhere in a militarized police force, that's not working.
I agree with you on that, too. And, you know, as you may have saw today, the Minnesota House DFL caucus just released our public safety proposal where we're actually, you know, prioritizing other forms of, you know, public safety, actually investing in the community groups who are out on the streets right now at this very moment, who are making sure that, you know, young people, when they leave the schools, that they can actually go home and not have to be fearful about their lives.
I will say just one last quick thing I note about the committees you're serving on. You're on the redistricting committee, correct?
I do serve on the redistricting, yes.
Can we laugh about the Republicans' plan for redistricting? The Republicans, because I don't know what pipe dream they were living in, but that ain't going to fly in Minnesota, what they wanted to do.
Yeah, I know. With what they're trying to do, I think, you know, they're just politicizing the process and not really working with us. As you saw for us in the House over this past summer and fall, we held a series of listening engagement to really hear, you know, what Minnesotans think about, you know, with regards to redistricting. And when we were going through the process, actually taking some of that feedback and amending our maps to make sure that we, you know, captured the voices of every Minnesotan from all across the state.
And just if you look at where the population growths are, I mean, this is the thing that really chafes the Republicans. There's just going to be natural district pickups for the Democrats. The DFL is going to pick up House seats. It's going to pick up Senate seats just because the population growth and this mentality that they're going to send, you know, go in with a microscope and, you know, carve out building by building to try to diffuse the power of the metro area and try to preserve five, you know, U.S. House seats and the rest of the state for them. You know, it just is ludicrous. And once again, it's not, my guess is it's not even coming from the state. I'm guessing it's someone nationally that's giving them guidance on this. But the reality is it's not looking out for what's best for Minnesotans. It's only looking out what's best for the Minnesota Republican Party.
Right. It is tough. You know, like I said, for us in the House, we had an open and transparent process. I know that, you know, we tried to engage with the Senate Republicans majority and how they went about, you know, their process. And we didn't really get any contact with them until very late when they were just exchanging press conferences and press releases. And so at least I know that, you know, for us in the House, we did our due diligence to hear and really make sure that our maps reflect, you know, the voices that we heard when we went through our process. And I'm grateful for that. And we look forward to the work that we have from now until the 15th to see if we could get a map done.
We can always hope the Republican Party decides to work with us, but hey, this is me not holding my breath. We do, regardless of these maps, we do have an election coming up here this fall. You know, how are you feeling about the upcoming election cycle?
You know, I'm very hopeful right now. With the pandemic, it's going to be tough, but I feel like, you know, if everyone is able to, you know, just maintain focus on with the work ahead and, you know, bring people out into the precinct caucuses. I know that, you know, many of us in the party and throughout the state are going to have contactless, you know, precinct caucus. We just need to make sure that people who want to be involved can be involved, so that once we get closer to the primary season and the general election season, that folks are fully informed about our candidates and actually get out to vote for our statewide candidates too, not just us in the state legislature.
Well, and this is the point where I tell everyone, if you want to help out Representative Lee, by all means, here you go. It's fulee.org, F-U-E-L-E-E.org, correct? That's still your website?
That is still my correct website.
Yeah, F-U-E-L-E-E.org. That's Representative Fulee. Go over there, volunteer, donate, help him hold on to 59A for the DFL. As well, and let's be honest, I don't think the Republicans are necessarily even going to run against you in that district. But I mean, obviously, it gives us the vibrant voice the DFL has always represented. And two, let's face it, I mean, it's as much as outstate Republicans like to scream, you got to make sure you have enough rural people in the negotiation sessions. We need to have Metro people in there too. And you know, you are bringing a perspective that has to be presented, because there's just too many people that want to ignore your district and ignore the city of Minneapolis when they write these bills. And thank God you're there, because your voice is heard and it's preventing, you know, catastrophe for the city, frankly. So I'm grateful that you're there, Representative.
Well, thank you for having me, and you are right. We need to make sure that the legislature is reflective of the residents of the entire state of Minnesota, and having represent this area for the last 6 years, we are one of the most demographically diverse districts in the state, and I believe, you know, after redistricting, we will remain so. And so it is important for your listeners to come out there, not just to, you know, help donate, but, you know, campaign and make sure that we could actually help out our colleagues and other candidates throughout the state too. You know, we're not just focusing on turning out voters in North Minneapolis for our statewide candidates. We are also making sure that we can get out there to help out other House DFL candidates, so that we can maintain the majority and continue the work that we are to make Minnesota a more progressive state.
Representative, we need to set up a bus where you and I will take a bunch of volunteers out to some of these other districts. The Fulee bus will take it on out, go out to these districts and help these people in these other communities, because not only will you, obviously we can help more DFLers win, but also then it basically allows you to present the issues of your district to everyone else. I think that's a fantastic idea.
I think so, too. You know, I'm on board. Maybe we can do it together, or, you know, find other members who are willing to jump onto this idea and just make it happen.
I like that. I'll be in touch with you guys there. Once again, Representative Fulee, it's F-U-E-L-E-E.org. You know, go to his website, sign up, volunteer, donate if you can, and let's make sure that we continue to have his fantastic leadership in the Minnesota House for as many years as we possibly can. Representative, an absolute privilege. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you, Matt.
Take care. Democrat of the day, Representative Lee. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Representative Fulee, 59A, Democrat of the day. Nice to have him here. Once again, Republicans, you want to be Republican of the day? Sure. Come on down. Come on in. The water's fine. I get to ask the questions. You're not going to like my questions, but you willing to answer my questions? Sure, I'll let you. Come on, I'll let you even promote your websites and stuff. So there you go. Patrick, how are you, my friend? And we didn't get a chance with the representative joining us right away here to say hello. Hello, sir.
Doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I would bring up my fantastic trip. I went out to Harriet, Lake Harriet this weekend. Went to the art shanties, went to the kite festival. Have you ever been to the kite festival out there?
I have not.
Good fun. That was actually a good time. Very enjoyable. Got out there and I got to see a lot of kites. It was cool. And I mean, I posted pictures of both the art shanties and the Kite Festival up on the Facebook page and the Twitter page. Go check those out. But I imagine your entire a good chunk of your weekend was watching what could, as many people are describing, is the greatest weekend of playoff football that has ever happened. Would you agree with that?
It's hard to disagree with that because Saturday's games were wild, and then it went up to 11 on Sunday with the two games that happened yesterday.
So, yeah, it was the Bengals winning. The first game was the Bengals beating the Titans on a last-second field goal. The next game was the 49ers beating the Green Bay Packers on a last-second field goal. The next game was the Rams beating the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on a last-second field goal. And then in the wildest game, you had the Kansas City Chiefs, who basically not only marched on the field with 14 seconds left to get a field goal going. I will say this. They did have, I believe, all three timeouts when they started that. So it's not as in – they were able to call timeouts and still get the – so they could run down the middle of the field and kind of get down there. It's not as impressive as doing it with no timeouts, but they still managed to tie the game with 14 seconds left, starting from their own 25-yard line, and then they won it in overtime to basically they moved on as well. And so it was amazing. You know sports better than I do. Is Aaron Rodgers done playing in Green Bay at this point?
I kind of think he is. The Packers are going to have a lot of free agent decisions to make this winter. They're over the salary cap. They're going to need to let some of this core go, this core that arguably has gotten them as far as they're going to go anyway. They have a number of holes, especially their...
Oh, special teams has got a big hole.
I'm surprised their special teams coach hasn't been fired yet after. They were bad all season, but then in the biggest moments, I mean, you had a field goal blocked, you had a punt blocked for a touchdown that tied the game. I mean, the Packers were sitting pretty. They were ahead 10-3 with 5 minutes left in that game, and everybody was just thinking about, oh, who's going to be the next victim next week? And then the punt block, and then the next thing you know, the Packers gave up 6 points defensively and lost the game.
I will say this to Green Bay Packer fans. You guys all went up in Madison's like, I can't believe you horrible Vikings fans sit there and make fun of a quality team who that's not your team and you mocking ridicule. Dude, okay, first of all, stop. Dude, I don't know if you understand what rivalry means, but you guys have been constantly bad-mouthing the Vikings. Constantly. So you getting a little bit of spoonful of what you've been dishing out, just suck it up and swallow. How about I say it like that? That being said, the new owner of the Green Bay Packers seems to be Jimmy Garoppolo. I couldn't believe the one stat or two stats that came out this weekend. One, we are going to have our first Super Bowl in 12 years that is not going to either include Brady or Rodgers in it, which is amazing. It's two. The other thing is that the Green Bay Packers are 0-4 against the San Francisco 49ers in the playoffs. There is not since the 1950s has one team had such a problem with another team, one individual team, to beat to get in the playoffs, but the 49ers just have their number.
Yeah, and that's the same deal actually with the Rams and the Bucs. The Rams who beat the Buccaneers yesterday despite that big rally by the Buccaneers late in the game. Last three meetings have been all won by the Rams.
So it will be interesting. It will be interesting. Green Bay, I'm just going to let you know, you've been blessed. I mean, there have been a few times in the history of football. Steve Montana to Young. You know, the San Francisco 49ers had two pro-level, all-star level quarterbacks back-to-back. You guys had Favre, you have Rodgers. And Rodgers is quite good. He's not Favre. I will, let's just call it what it is. He's not Favre. And he's not Drew Brees. And he's going to go away. Because I think he doesn't want to be in Green Bay anymore. I don't think as Patrick brought up, I think that he realizes there's going to be a change over there. But, yeah, he's not going to be there. So get ready for it, because one of the things I find is funny is Republicans like to, we are such a an honored and traditional franchise. Dude, you guys don't remember the 70s and 80s when no one went to those games. Holy God, you could kick a soccer ball in sections of Lambeau Field and not hit a single fan on some of those games. Yeah, I don't think you're going to have a good season next year. I'm going to let you know, unless you basically can find a quarterback, that, you know, someone who's willing to trade away their top-level quarterback, I don't think you're going to do that well. So there you go. We're done talking sports. We've got the sports out of the way. Done, finite. I did go out to the art shanties. Art shanties were fun. There was some interesting ones where people were like kind of locked into the art shanty, and they would do things through the walls. I thought that was pretty good. The kites were amazing. The best one was only up for a little bit. There, some guy had an Easter Island head kite that was great. And it just was up for a little bit. I mean, I don't think there was enough wind. I mean, it was windy a little bit out there, but, you know, later on, things kind of died down. But great fun. The lake was packed. I mean, there was a lot of people out there enjoying the fun out there. I hope you had a good weekend. I'm looking forward. Next weekend's the big week, and that's the beginning of the Winter Carnival. And as a matter of fact, I think Winter Carnival starts on Wednesday. Is it on Wednesday? Anyway. I'm looking forward to it. It's one of my favorite things to do all year long is a Winter Carnival. I'm looking forward to that. I hope you're getting out because, yeah, it's cold, it's dark, but if you just stay inside the entire time, yeah, it gets rough. It gets rough. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. I'll get into the Minnesota coronavirus update and Jack Rice at the top of the hour to talk about the latest trial for the three officers that were with Derek Chauvin when he killed George Floyd. We'll talk about the opening statements in that trial going on today. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Let's get into the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Monday's COVID-19 update from the Department of Health includes 12,722 newly reported cases, 42 newly reported deaths. State's COVID-19 death toll now is 11,193. Today's update includes case data that was reported in the 24-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Friday, January 21st, but due to the Omicron surge overloading the health department, there remains approximately 45,000 positive tests that are yet to be processed, including in the daily reports. So as you can see, each of the days is slightly exaggerated than what it kind of would be normally represented. Although the argument would be, well, when the tests come through, the tests come through. I'm not sure there. Last week, the Mayo Clinic had a press briefing, which it said it expected the reported cases to remain high after peaking perhaps this week. However, more because reported cases lagged, what's reporting in real time, the Omicron wave might have already peaked in Minnesota. Minnesota's test positivity rate on the 7-day rolling average through January 11th was 23.7, which is another record high in Minnesota. Anything over 10% puts Minnesota in the high-risk threshold. Through January 21st, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 1,566, which is down from the 1,572 reported on January 20th. Of those hospitalized, 238 people are in intensive care. That's down from 241. That's 1,328 in non-ICU care. That's down from 1,330. The latest hospital capacity data shows there are 29 staffed adult ICU beds available in the entire state, down from 34 on January 20th. And 21 pediatric ICU beds available, which is up from 17 on January 20th. As of January 19th, the state reported that 3,816,297 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,575,871 people have completed their vaccine series. And the state has administered 1,962,781 third dose booster shots. The total amount of people who have been sick in the state of Minnesota, 1,229,444. I don't know if we'll get to a quarter of the state population. Pray we don't. I pray we don't. Getting sick, but we're close to, we're if not over, a fifth of the entire state's population, one-fifth, 20% of the population getting COVID. You know, I'm going to get into, you know, masks and anti-vaxxers and all that crap here in just a second, but The reality is, and I want to make sure people hear this, because you have to hear this. We have decided that mild inconvenience or even a major inconvenience is far more important than stopping needless suffering, stopping needless death. Nope. People need to suffer. People need to die because I want to be able to sit in the Chili's and have my Southwest egg rolls with dipping sauce. I got into a good conversation today with a good friend of mine who is also someone who considers themselves a Christian. And we both just, you know, kind of shake our heads at these so-called Christians that like to sit there and say, we're anti-vax and I want to be able to go into the Buffalo Wild Wings. No. If you actually read, I don't know, the story of Jesus, if you're a Christian, you should be for healthcare. You should be for, you know, looking out for the betterment of everyone else. It was never about, I'm a selfish big baby boy and I want what I want now. It was never. That is not Christianity. And there's a lot of people who think that's what Christianity is Jesus gives me eggs and chocolate on Easter and Jesus gives me presents on Christmas. And they think that's what it is. They think that's what it is. It isn't. It really isn't. And once again, my religious disclaimer, you do or don't do whatever it is you do or don't want to do. I'm a former Catholic, still considering myself Christian. Found myself a nice little church. Actually, two of them I like. The reality is that we should be, whether it's because of religious ideals or just civic ideals, being a decent freaking human being, we should be for stopping the needless suffering, stopping the needless deaths, versus I don't want to be inconvenienced in any way, shape, or form. I'll get to another idiot celebrity here. Was it RFK Jr. that was out at the anti-vax thing? I think it was RFK Jr., right?
Yeah, that was him.
He made the comparison that anti-vaxxers today are the same exact thing as Anne Frank, the little girl who basically hid from the Nazis in the walls of her building for years to prevent from being either shipped to a work camp to be forced labor or to an extermination camp to be executed as part of the Holocaust, while every family possession they had was stolen from them by the Nazis. And that idiot thinks because he can't go to the Applebee's and sit down and eat inside the restaurant that he has to have his dinner to go, that's the same thing. Selfishness. It is selfishness is the one American virtue we display on a god-awful level in this country. Just a god-awful level. I'm tired of it. Selfishness is not a good look. It really isn't. And I'm tired of it. I'm for stopping the needless suffering. I'm for stopping the needless deaths. If you're sitting there saying, I don't care, I want to go do what I want to do and I don't want any inconveniences, well, you're a jackass. And let's just call it what it is. You're a jackass. You have the right, and I've said this before, you say, and your first response is probably saying, see, Matt's saying if I'm against the vaccine, I'm a bad guy. No. You don't want to get vaccinated. I've said this a few times. That's perfectly fine. There comes personal responsibility with that decision. And that's what you don't want. You don't want the consequences of your decision. You might lose your job. You can't necessarily go over to someone's house and have drinks without basically them saying you need to wear a mask or leave. You're not going to be able to go to a restaurant. Those are the consequences. You just don't want the consequences. You want to make decisions and not have any consequences. That's not freedom. That's just being a selfish jackass. And that's all you are. And the consequences of your selfishness are needless suffering. I don't have any problem saying this because we have to have someone in this freaking country that's going to call this crap out. And that's what we are doing. I'm doing at least. You don't want to get vaccinated? Fine. Then stay home. Wear a mask. Understand that there are going to be certain things you can't do for the betterment of yourself and the betterment of society. Stop having your freaking temper tantrums, you spoiled little Veruca Salt. A severely ill COVID-19 patient flown from Minnesota to Texas during a legal battle on whether the ventilator should be turned off has died on Saturday. Scott Quiner, who is unvaccinated, was being kept alive by a machine at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids, north of Minneapolis, after contracting COVID-19 in October. His family sued the hospital over a move to disconnect Quiner, and the judge issued a restraining order on January 13, blocking Mercy from turning off the machine. Last weekend, the family flew him to Texas, where he was being treated at a Houston hospital, but he died on Saturday morning. The family story drew national attention, basically. He became a darling of the far right. But, okay, I've got more questions about this. And I feel sorry for the family because loss is loss. And I'm consistent. I don't want anyone dead. I feel sorry for this guy. And I feel sorry for the family. But your attempt to blame Mercy Hospital, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. We're absolutely devastated, said the family lawyer Marjorie Holston said on Saturday. Now, this is the same person that said, when he got to Houston, they said he was the most malnutrition patient ever. Okay, all the rest of his organs were functioning outside of his lungs. You don't understand the side effects of malnutrition if you're saying that he was. And my guess is you're exaggerating something a doctor said or someone who really was saying something for a political reason. You're trying to transfer that into a medical diagnosis. No, you can't be the most malnourished person and still have all your organs working except for your lungs. On behalf of the Quiner family, I would like to thank the public for outpouring love and support during this difficult ordeal. We ask for privacy for Ann and the children as they grieve the loss of Scott, a wonderful husband and father. Holston says she does not know when Quiner lost consciousness, but that 2 days ago, and this is a statement from the lawyer. 2 days ago, his daughter FaceTimed with him. She was saying, Dad, I love you, and his eyes welled with tears. His brain was there. 2 days later than he was dead. And unless they're saying that the Texas hospital murdered him, he died of the consequences of COVID. Now, I want to bring that up because did you bring him out of his medically induced coma just so he could FaceTime people? I that's what it sounds like. So let's go through the timeline here. There's kind of been this impression that Mercy Hospital put him on the ventilator. No, they didn't. It was a hospital in Laconia put him on the ventilator. When he was transferred to Mercy, he was already ventilated. He basically hadn't used his lungs without the help of a machine for 2 months. From every medical professional I've seen or heard from, they weren't about to start working again. And I can understand hope, and you understand this stuff. But this idea, they were upset because he lost a lot of weight. Well, I can tell you right now, if you're lying still in a hospital bed for 2 months on a ventilator, you're going to lose a lot of weight because you're going to lose a lot of muscle mass. My dad, who wasn't basically stuck on a ventilator, but after he had his stroke, was in a bed. He was in a bed for the most part by himself. He couldn't really move around too much. And he dramatically lost weight. I mean, that's just what happens, is that you will lose weight when you're in the hospital for an extended period of time, not able to move. I have a friend of mine. I talked about my friend last summer who went through this horrible, state of COVID. And he lost a ton of weight because he was basically lying on a ventilator. So this idea that he was malnourished because he had lost weight, no, that's just what happens when you're in a hospital bed on a ventilator and not moving. You're losing, most of what you're losing is muscle mass. And if you think I'm just pulling that on my, go talk to a dietitian. That's kind of what happens. So that's not unexplained weight loss. That's explained weight loss. And the narrative was being pushed forward to vilify Mercy for some reason. And like I said, I think, okay, Mercy didn't ventilate him. Waconia Hospital ventilated him. Mercy was taking care of him. He lost weight because that's what happens when you lie stagnant in a bed for a long time on a ventilator. That wasn't Mercy torturing him and trying to kill him, as it's been implied. And it seems as if, you know, this idea that he was the most, you know, this argument that apparently some Texas doctor, and by the way, Texas healthcare sucks. It is horrible. Really, overall, Minnesota healthcare is 1,000 times better than Texas. But some doctor in Texas says he was the most malnutrition patient I've ever seen. Yet all of his other organs were working, which that's not malnutrition. He just lost weight. And I mean, because like I said, you need to understand the consequences, the physical consequences of extreme malnutrition. Your organs are starting to fail at that point. So that didn't make any sense how all of his organs were working. That justified moving him. But when you got down there, oh, he was malnourished. That doesn't make sense. But it's this whole thing of, well, we FaceTimed with him. Wait a second here. So did you just go to this Texas hospital because they were going to wake him up out of his medically induced coma so you could do FaceTime videos with him? I'm a little confused by what was going on here. And I've said that it feels like the family wanted a hospital experience, which was like a grill your own steak place where they could go in there and make the decisions. And the last I checked, my wife has cancer. I can't walk into a hospital and say, hey, my wife's got cancer. I want you to treat her with meth. And when they say, are you crazy? No, we're not going to treat your cancer patient wife with meth. You say, hey, I read on Google and there's this one guy that's a doctor who says meth is perfect for cancer. You're violating my civil rights. I don't do that. I don't do that when I go to an architectural firm. I don't do that when I talk to a plumber. I don't do that when I go to a restaurant and there I meet the chef. I don't say that thing when I go to a hospital. And there's doctors and nurses. They know what they're doing. I'm sorry that you lost a loved one. I don't get the impression from everything I've read in this story that Mercy had anything to do with it. I think it was, you're looking for a villain. You've created one. I would say I've got some serious questions about what the hell they were doing to your husband slash father down in Houston if they woke him up so he could just do FaceTime calls and then 2 days later he's dead. That doesn't seem like healthcare to me. But the reality, you know, this is, you know, people get, I get it. You're angry, you're upset, you're looking for a boogeyman, and Mercy Hospital has become it. I might suggest the lack of vaccination was the first problem. Like I said, I might suggest that. I was vaccinated. I had boosted. I got COVID completely asymptomatic. And 5 days later, I tested negative. I'd rather do it that way than be on a ventilator for an extended period of time. That's just me. But that's just me. Wacky, crazy me. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. More on the coronavirus update when I return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. When I had my hip replacement surgery, I was at home and I was still moving around, but I still lost 10 pounds because I just wasn't moving that much. In the 2 weeks before I could start getting really around again without, you know, I was with crutches for a while there. But Joe making a comment on the live stream. You can watch the radio show if you like over at Facebook at am950radio.com or Progressive Citizen X Matt McNeil Show. I was in a coma for 5 days and bedridden for a month. I lost 15 pounds and had to learn how to walk again. That's just a common thing. I mean, I understand what you're trying to say is, well, he's lost a lot of weight. Well, you generally, if you're lying stagnant in a bed on a ventilator, you're not picking up pounds. If you are the hospital, the hospital is probably doing something wrong then. Or there's another condition that they've not diagnosed. But, you know, this argument that he lost 30 pounds while he was on the ventilator, not moving in the bed, well, that's kind of what happens. And so, like I said, the vilification of mercy here, I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, from what I'm reading here, it doesn't seem to be very justified. It just doesn't seem to be justified. It looks like, once again, the family's trying to find a boogeyman to... I'm going to take a guess. I'll take a guess. Maybe just to offset their guilt about not getting vaccinated. And so it's not the fact that we didn't get vaccinated. It's, oh, Mercy Hospital, even though they didn't ventilate him. That was the Waconia Hospital, even though he losing weight in the hospital is pretty standard, even though he clearly wasn't malnourished if he went down there and all of his organs, but his lungs were still working. And what the heck was the Texas hospital doing? There seems to be some questions about what they were doing for sure. Whoopi Goldberg blasted HBO's Bill Maher as the increasingly right-moving comedian declared he doesn't want to live in a pro-vaccine Americans mass paranoid world anymore. Like I said, selfishness over an unnecessary suffering. On Monday's The View, Goldberg called Maher's remarks not really funny to people who have lost their kids or family members and dear friends to this. And she said, apparently meaning to COVID, she obviously... making a valid point there. Maher on his HBO show on Friday said, I don't want to live in a paranoid world anymore. Your mask paranoid world anymore. You know, you go out, it's silly now. You have to wear your mask. You have to have a card. You have to have a booster. You have to scan your head like a cashier, a bunch of bananas. You know, he's exaggerating that. Goldberg continued, listen, nobody on the planet really wants to go through this. And it's not something we're doing because it's, you know, sexually gratifying. That's what we're doing to protect our families. You don't have to do it to stay away from everyone, because if you're not the one who's not paying attention and you're not confident and your confidence needs, you don't want them to stay out of the public man. This is not, nobody wants this. I don't want it. And I think you're forgetting the people who are still at risk, who cannot get vaccinated, people who can get little kids under the age of 5. Yeah, this is her direct quote. Needless to say, yeah, Maher, selfishness is not a good look, dude. Hour 2 is up next.
This is Chad, owner of AM950 for Snap Construction again.
AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Monday. Good to be with you, Matt. Patrick here. Jack Rice is kind enough to join us, the best defense lawyer in town. You can go to find Jack Rice Defense at jackricelaw.com. That's jackricelaw.com. He is joining us today to talk about the beginnings of the latest trial involving the death of George Floyd. That is the federal trial of the other three officers. Jack, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Matt, it's great to be with you again.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you, my friend. Let's start talking about this. I mean, first of all, let's go back a few days to the beginning of this trial and the beginning of the jury selection and the trial against Lane, King, and Tao. These are the other three officers who are on the scene, two of which helped hold down George Floyd. The other one was standing there making comments while the other, Derek Chauvin murdered him and the other two officers helped. That's not me. You know, I don't think I'm kind of a bouncer. I've seen the videos. That's kind of what happened. This is a federal case. It's not the Hennepin County case, correct?
That's correct. In fact, that Hennepin County case has been continued. Originally, that was set to start in March, but it's been pushed back to June. So in other words, there's two different things going on right now. And the same thing happened with Chauvin, actually. There are the state cases, the state trial in Hennepin County, where Derek Chauvin was found guilty, and those three other officers are waiting for trials in June. Then there are federal charges where they essentially were all charged with constitutional rights violations against George Floyd. Now, we know that Derek Chauvin has already pled guilty in the federal case to run alongside the state case. The other three are being charged, and they're in the middle of a trial right now.
One of the things that was interesting is at the beginning of this trial, the judge came on out and said, this case is not about racism. And, is it because they're dealing with the civil rights violation? Because, I mean, is he trying to split a hair there? Or I didn't quite understand where he was going with that. What was it? you know, is it a case where he's just trying to establish this is the law and this is how the law should be applied, versus is this some sort of Kyle Rittenhouse thing where the judge is, you know, kind of seeming to make rulings on the one side?
Well, I think that what Magnuson's really trying to do in this case is to say that race is not a required element here. Race is not a piece of this case in the sense that the evidence must show on its face that what these people did is they deprived George Floyd his constitutional rights. It's not a race question. It's not how they did it or even why they did it, but whether they did it. And I think that's what he's trying to establish. I also think that a big part of this is to try to sort of calm the situation. Let's face it, the entire world was looking at Minneapolis and St. Paul for a really long period of time. And I think what he's trying to do, what a lot of people have been talking about, is the idea of trying to calm people down to realize, let's let this process take its course.
The jury selection that did happen last week, it very different. Once again, it's not just drawing from Hennepin County, it's being drawn from the entire state, correct?
That's correct. I mean, federal trials are fundamentally different than state trials. I mean, you can look back at other trials in the past. They can take weeks and weeks for jury selection in state court. The difference between state court and federal court is pretty profound, at least when it comes to jury selection stuff. What happens is the judge controls a lot of it. So in other words, what you'll find is that there will be questionnaires that went out to all these potential jurors. But in the end, the judge really asks just about everything. And they really don't give the attorneys much wiggle room. And so as a result, there were only a few follow-ups in this case before they picked 12 juries plus six alternates.
The jury selection, and you and I have talked about this in past cases, in this case, it's predominantly white. I guess I don't understand to a point. I mean, I know as you just described, there are the differences between a federal trial and a state trial. But at the same time, I mean, is the screening process the same? Is it similar at least? Where you know you at least try to find people who is like, oh yeah, I love the cops and I never find a cop guilty. Well, clearly that person should be removed from the jury.
Well, there's no question about it, and in fact, a lot of those very same questions would have been asked during that questionnaire. So that's a big piece of it. I mean, one of the things that I think is important to remember is this, is that is race an issue? Race is always an issue. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but it is, in the sense that people look at people and they have preconceived notions, whether they want to acknowledge it or not. And that is just simply the truth. Now, what rolls out of that is the idea that if I have preconceived notions, does that mean that I perceive people differently? Yes, we all do. At the same time, do I think that some people are more honest than others? That's really part of this question, right? But if we think about the jury pool itself, think of it like this. The jury pool in Minneapolis is the most diverse in the state of Minnesota. And St. Paul is pretty close thereafter as well. But you get into greater Minnesota, it changes dramatically. So in other words, what you could see is while Minneapolis is about 75% white, give or take 25% people of color, what you're going to find is you go to St. Cloud, you go to Duluth, you go to Bemidji, you go to Marshall, you go outside, all of a sudden you see dynamics like this. Hence what we have are the estimates I'm hearing right now of the 12 jurors plus the six alternates, the breakdown is essentially like this. We have about, 10 women. We have 8 men, and about 16 of the 18 appear to be white. That's about as good as we're getting right now in terms of the numbers, I mean.
You know, when I remember, was it the case of... was it Fernando Castillo when they had his trial? They had one woman on the trial who owned a business that had a contract with the police. And it always blew my mind. It's like, how in the world does that person get on the jury? Do you think that, you know, I maybe that's the perspective I have here is that is I think I'm looking at this in the modern sense of jury selection in Minneapolis or in Hennepin County, I should say, that it just doesn't seem like, yeah, you clearly have, you can't anymore have ringers on the jury. We're not going to allow that. We have to have people that can evaluate a court, you know, a case, you know, straightforward. And we have that. We had that case. We had, of course, the case up in Brooklyn Center. You know, you have guilty charges now being placed on police officers, and they're going to jail. Muhammad Noor as well. But yeah, I mean, yeah, well, so I kind of is that same standard? You know, is that the same standard, or do they still have some of that, a little bit of that old style of, well, you know, we'll try to trim this back as best as we can, but we can't really guarantee that we're going to be able to screen all of this out of the jurors?
Well, see, that's part of the problem, right? I mean, part of the problem is, and I picked a lot of juries in my career, everything from just simple assault to murders. And the problem with these is that you don't always get the information that you want. Now, frequently, you may get very little to nothing from some people as to how they actually feel, what they actually believe. There will be some people out there who will simply say, yes, I can be fair, and there's your standard. The problem is frequently the jury that you get is the jury that you know the least about. So in other words, people who say terrible things, you're like, oh, my God, that person has to go. And yet, I recall a really serious case that I was dealing with where one of the potential jurors was actually the wife of a chief of police, and I had to fight to get that person off the jury, even though that person actually knew some of the other people who would potentially be witnesses. And part of that comes because what you find is that judges want to seat juries. They want cases to start. And so for them, their inclination is to get things moving. Well, sometimes my inclination is to figure out where I am so we can actually have a fair jury. I'm not saying the judge doesn't want that too, but they also are watching the clock.
Yeah.
So that's sort of part of the problem.
I think that that's good. Between the two things, the statement about there's not race involved, and then they sat that jury real fast. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here? I appreciate you clarifying this for me, because I think I'm a little bit off the edge.
I have to tell you, Matt, I mean, that's it is part of the issue though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can even remember, think back to the Chauvin trial where you all of a sudden had one person who came out later that was actually at a function in Washington, D.C., involved in potentially the debate of George Floyd wearing a shirt that says, keep any off my neck or something along those lines.
Yeah.
You could make the argument he's a ringer the other direction. But the problem is neither side, prosecution nor defense, ever knew about it until after it was over. So what do you do when you just don't know who the people are that are actually potentially a jurors? That's one of the difficulties of picking a jury, why it's so challenging.
The officers have an interest, you know, like I said, the video, we've seen the video. They've got a very interesting, you know, problem ahead of them, because they have to basically say what you see with your own eyes is not really what happened. The defense has put forward their opening statements today. Thomas Plunkett, the attorney for King, described his client as a rookie officer failed by the Minneapolis Police Department's inadequate training. He said he only saw that was right in front of him rather than the wide view, the bystander video. That video is not what King saw, said Plunkett. I'm going to presume that's going to be something the other officers are going to try to argue too. Tao's lawyer called the death a tragedy, although a tragedy is not a crime. Now, Tao, it should be mentioned, was not an officer on top of George Floyd when he died. So it's going to be interesting to see his case. But trying these all three together, I mean, is that the best defense for them, is to take the myopic look, to say, well, from where I say, yeah, you guys got this video where you're standing 10 feet behind me. I'm just looking at the part of the body I was sitting on. I'm looking at the crowd. I wasn't paying attention to what was going on, to basically just boil it down to what was in front of their eyes and hope that that offsets the videos.
Well, I think you have to do that to some degree, because imagine if you have 14 different views of a scene, some of which are 25 feet up from a camera on the top of a building that's looking down on the scene, to lots and lots of other views from vest cams, from individuals, all those things. Just because somebody else sees something doesn't mean that the person themselves does. But I think an interesting aspect of this case, regardless of what people saw or didn't see, is that this is slightly different than a lot of people might consider. because the idea of depriving constitutional rights is kind of an inverse argument. Because if you think about it, what you're having to say is, it's not what they did. It's what they were supposed to do and didn't do. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's actually different than one might think. I mean, one of the examples, and this is one of the interesting ones, regarding our former officer Lane. The guy was on the force for 4 days, a grand total of 4 days. He's the same officer who actually said, shouldn't we roll him over twice? They have it on tape. And so we have him asking this question. You have a very senior officer who was the lead officer, Derek Chauvin, saying no to him. And then the second time that Lane asks, Derek Chauvin actually ignores him. And so the question becomes, what is a four-day on the force officer to do where an officer of 15-plus years, whatever the number is it tells you no very specifically and then ignores you thereafter? Because in many ways, a lot of police officers and police departments see themselves very military-like, and so the idea is it's hierarchical. Mm-hmm. We do what we're told. We are trained by the officers above us, and we do our best, but they're the ones who tell us what to do. But see, that's not what the law says. The law in this case is much different than that. What the law actually says is you have obligations. Officers must intervene when they see that excessive force has been used. Or, in this case, what they're also saying is when they see the need to get medical attention for somebody. That's, in fact, all three of those officers are charged with that. So in this case, it's one of those things where, and this is actually what the prosecutor said today, it doesn't matter that they were new officers. They still had obligations. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're going to get from some of the from some of their defense counsel is that realistic? Is that fair? Does that make any sense? And I think that's one of the questions you're going to put before a jury. And that's what they're going to have to answer.
And that's the interesting element is, like, you were trained, weren't you? You don't just become a welder. You have to go to welder school. You can't just be a
Correct.
Cop. And it's interesting. There's that case. I don't know if you've seen the video of I think it was in Texas where the guy was, getting out of line with the suspect. The female officer grabs the officer by the utility belt and does what she's supposed to do and pulls him back. And the other officer whips around and starts choking her. And it was all caught on tape. And now that guy is under investigation, obviously, as he should be. But it does present an interesting case where there she did. I mean, there literally was a case where she literally grabbed the cop and pulled him off and said, no, you can't do this. And the officer, there were consequences for that when that officer tried to choke her. No one you don't see, if I'm the prosecutor, that's what I'm going to point to. Is like, at no point did anyone here try to pull Derek Chauvin off of George Floyd as they should have.
Well, how's this for a twist? If I'm not mistaken, that's a pretty old case where that officer is actually they're looking at now. That case goes back to about 2007. You know what happened to that officer who pulled him off? She was fired. So let's think about that for a second, right? I mean, this adds to the mix. I'm not saying good, bad, left, right, nothing. It's a question of when you think about the process and you think about the nature of police departments, the real question that's going to happen in this case, and I think this is actually the really big part of what this is about, if you think about what's really important is this idea of intervention, whether or not police should intervene and why they must intervene. But the second part is about the training of intervention. What kind of training, and this is exactly what Tom Plunkett for King said, was what kind of training are these officers receiving about not just use of force, but what happens when you have an officer or maybe even a senior officer telling you what to do and what you're supposed to do in response. So what we're trying to see now is, does this change the behavior of not just these officers, but Minneapolis police officers, frankly, police officers across the country?
By the way, just FYI, that case I was referring to, I just pulled it up. It's January 15th. It was in Sunrise, Florida, actually, not Texas. And the sergeant did that. So it's a current, that one is actually a current case.
That's a current
case. Well, how many? That's a sad world when we actually can. There are multiple officers choking other officers cases that we can refer to. That is the better strategy, though, as you just brought up, for these officers that are on trial. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the Minneapolis Police Department does not seem to have the best track record when it comes to training people. That Rolling Stone article is a great example. They could just throw the department under the bus, and I think that might actually be a decent defense.
By the way, the one I was talking about, there was a Buffalo officer. Her name was Carol Horn. She was fired after intervening in a 2006 case in which there was a chokehold in Sunrise, Florida. Wow. 2006. That's the case you're talking about.
Oh, my God. That's.
Come on, brother. Oh, I got you.
It could be the same. It could be the same town, different cases. Because this one actually, this case is from January 13th. The video is from January 13th of this year. Yeah. So
it's a brutal question right now, and I think part of the problem is obviously there is a history in this country of police misconduct, and there is a history in this country of people looking the other way, being deferential to the police and simply saying, oh, it's a tough job, and that's the end of it. Of course, people then bury their parents, they bury their children, they bury their cousins, they bury their neighbors. And you say, well, you know, too bad, so sad. Well, guess what? That simply is unacceptable anymore. The question will be for this jury is that are they going to see this and say, too bad, so sad? Or are they going to look at it from the defense perspective of, these are brand new cops. How do you hold them at a level of responsibility that you hold the Derek Chauvins of the world? Are they different? The standards say there is no difference. The prosecution is saying there is no difference. The standard is the same whether you've been on the force for 20 years or for 2 days. And so will the jury agree?
You are much smarter than me. You got me on that one there.
Let's write this down.
We'll send you a copy. You can use this as your ringtone. Jack Rice is smarter than me. There you go. One final question for you on this one. Okay, so and just as a legal mind here. So here's the trouble these officers run into. With the federal case now going before the Hennepin County case, if they're found not guilty by the federal case, then there seems to be going to be probably a lot of pressure on the Hennepin County case to, you know, that's going to take that into account. Is anyone going to hold these officers accountable? If they're found guilty in the federal case, then the opposite might weigh true. I mean, am I right? I mean, is that there are going to be consequences for whatever the ruling in this case is that is going to have an impact on the Hennepin County case, correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Anything that happens first impacts what comes thereafter. Some could make the argument that those consequences for those officers have already come, meaning they've lost their jobs, meaning that they're running through two sets of trials, both federal and state trials, plus the insanity that comes with that, the financial responsibility that comes with that, but they've never really spent time in jail or in prison. At the same time, how about if you think of it like this? If you look at the federal case, because technically the law is so slippery on this issue, the standard is actually this. Because somebody died, because George Floyd was murdered, and if they can prove that this was part of that process, that technically, they could face the death penalty for this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. Certainly up to life in prison. If we remember George Floyd's murderer, Derek Chauvin, ultimately will serve between 20 and 25 years, but that's really going to run concurrent to the 22 and a half years that he's serving in state court, and so as a result, it's basically a concurrent sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as I understand it, there was no offer made to any of these three defendants at this point. So in a way, I sort of understand the logic of saying, hey, if I open myself up and plead guilty to something without any end date, is that really a smart idea? So there it is.
Can you? I'll tell you what. I might have to call on you again over the next few days here if we get some more developments in this case. If you're available, I'd love to have you back on, my friend.
Always, you know that.
The best defense attorney in Minneapolis-St. Paul is Jack Rice. JackRiceLaw.com. That's JackRiceLaw.com. That's where you'll find Jack Rice Defense. Give him a call. Sit down. Discuss your case with him. He'll give you the straightforward truth. You want to have a defense attorney you can trust. You can trust Jack Rice. I trust him emphatically. Jack Rice, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today, my friend.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Take care. Jack Rice, we'll spotlight Jack every time. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. going to be interesting in that case, because as he says, you know, just it's a harder, to a point, it's a harder case to prove on the federal charges. But like I said, it's the double-edged sword, because if you're found not guilty in the federal case, well, I guarantee you there's going to be a lot of outrage, and especially in the metro area, at the three officers. And then you've got to do the other trial. And I, you know, if you're found not guilty in the federal case, I'm going to say it's going to be very difficult to find a jury that's going to find you not guilty in the Hennepin County case. And so it will be interesting to see. I think maybe their best hope is to, you know, hope they can delay the trial until the after the election, and hope that Keith Ellison doesn't win re-election, and then say, well, then it's going to be Hennepin County attorney is going to prosecute, and that's, and hopefully that will change the dynamic. But the reality is yeah, that's the tricky part of this whole thing. Is where do you go? I mean, if this comes back, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to have my gut feeling is going to be that you're going to see a fairly, if they're found not guilty in the federal case, they're going to be a pretty substantial push, and at least locally, for a guilty verdict at some point. And yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on the jury. That will be for sure. It will definitely put a lot of pressure on the jury. You know, it's not a bad and the other thing I wanted to mention that Jack had brought up, it's not a bad argument for them to say, well, the Minneapolis Police Department is crap at training their officers, because you really can't that's actually a very provable argument. The problem is that here's the craziness of our country right now. They could actually use that as legitimate argument to not be found guilty in the federal case. But then we'll say, yeah, the Minneapolis Police Department is horrible at training their people, and yet there will be no consequences for the Minneapolis Police Department to improve the training. Just, it will only apply in this case against these three officers as the reason why they weren't very good at it. So, you know, it's, once again, I just want to make sure I remind Mayor Fry and the city council and police union, tick-tock goes the clock. Because I guarantee you, if you guys do not figure out some way to fix how the Minneapolis Police Department is working right now, you are going to have another ballot initiative, and it will pass. And yeah, it's not much you can do about it. There's not going to be much you can do about it. So if I were you, I'd be trying to find some way to address the mistakes of past police administrations and police union administrations. And fix this sooner rather than later. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Some observations when I do return. 952-946-6205, The Matt McNeil Show on a Monday on AM 950. I'm a little upset right now, Patrick, if you want to know the truth. So this is I got these Minnesota Twins reusable drinking cups, right? From my love of the Twins games, okay? They got this straw in there. It's perfect, because I'm a klutz, man, and I spill constantly. They're perfect. It's basically a sippy cup for an adult, okay? Let's just call it what it is. Well, there's a hole in the straw. So there is nothing funnier than watching me try to figure out, why is my sucking not working anymore? Well, if you've listened to the show, it works every day. But I'm spraying myself like it's a lawn sprinkler.
Now, with the straw built in that you would have to replace the lid too?
I don't know if I can find this type of straw. I don't know that Michaels has these sort of things, but I think this one's done. I'm upset. You know what this means? I gotta go buy a new thing, because that's my last one.
Uh-oh.
I wear through these things. God, but I'm like coated in my lemonade water at this point. Thank God it's not ant season. I'd be like a crawling, you know, mound at this point.
Well, it's a good thing you're not wearing a white shirt. Some people would be wondering about your bathroom abilities.
It's my glandular issue. Back off. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So, two things I want to bring up. Now, like I said, there's been a it's a weekend, so I did a lot of thinking about things. And that carried over into today. I mean, I talked about in the first hour the woman that took her husband down to Texas where sadly he passed away. But, man, there's a lot of questions about that case that doesn't seem to make sense. And, you know, if they end up suing Mercy Hospital, it's going to be interesting that if Mercy did everything right, is the argument going to be, well, we should have the right as patients to overrule any medical treatment that the hospital provides and make the hospital do the treatments we want them to do. That's the key. Everyone has the option. I mean, I mentioned cancer earlier. You have cancer. You have the choice. You can have the surgery and the chemotherapy and this, or you can basically say, you know what? I'll live the rest of my life. I'm not going to do the surgery. I'm not going to do the treatments. I don't want to do that. I'll live with the cancer and see how long I can go. I may try some homeopathic medication, so I'll try that. That's your option. You have that option. But what you generally don't have the option to do is tell a doctor, I don't care what your fancy medical degree says. I was told by Tucker Carlson to get the ivermectin. So you go get the ivermectin and give it to my husband. I mean, does a family of a patient at a hospital have the right to force their medical treatment force a doctor to do the medical treatment they want to do on a patient, even though there might not be any scientific basis for said medical treatment. And, you know, as people say, oh, God, no court in the world is going to come back and say that there's going to be the case. I don't know. The way our courts are working right now, I could see something like that. Now, the offsetting thing would be this. The minute that you overrule a doctor, you would have to sign away any liability whatsoever on anything with the hospital, which is where I think most people would then say, no, I'm not going to do that. But, and also then you'd have to find a doctor who'd be willing to do it, because I don't think you can force a doctor to do health medications that they disagree with. So, but we talked about that. I got to thinking about that. This morning, speaking of COVID, there were two other stories which got me thinking, both out of the Star Tribune. The first one, okay, it was just the headline of the story is just such a loaded headline. And it's the one that says, Minnesota schools look at staff shortages rather than COVID infections as the cause of their problems. But then the story it says itself is that, well, the reason why there are staffing shortages is because of COVID. That's like one of those arguments like when you hear the Confederate apologists say, well, the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about states' rights. And then you say, well, what states' rights specifically was the South trying to preserve? Well, the right to have slaves, but that's irrelevant. It was about states' rights. Well, no, it was about slavery. And you can try to candy coat it by saying it's states' rights. They actually said slavery in many of the Articles of Secession, so it was about slavery. You know, in this case, you know, it's I don't know what the Star Tribune is trying to do here, but it's this article is just garbage because, you know, you stop trying to make excuses for, you know, for people out there that don't want to believe that COVID's a problem. I mean, that's what this seems to be. It's like, you know, it's like, how do we make the anti-vaxxers feel better about themselves? Well, it's not COVID that's a problem. It's a staffing issues. Well, why are there staffing issues? Because everybody's got COVID. Okay, then it is COVID. No, don't say that, because it's not COVID. It's staffing issues. What? There was another doozy of a story. And it talked about natural immunity from COVID. And I'm going to just read this. And it's Brianna's story here. And so I'm kind of flabbergasted by this one. Minnesota Republicans are turning to natural immunity from COVID-19 as a way to push back on vaccine mandates, arguing that hospitals, businesses, and public institutions should consider past infections in exempting some from requirements. The idea is gaining traction in Republican-led legislatures around the country, despite pushback from public health officials who say protection from the infection varies dramatically from case to case. Now, I would make the argument then the next thing in this story should have been the final, you know, four paragraphs of the story. And I'm going to just read the final four paragraphs because this is where you get a lot of context. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention studied adult hospitalized for COVID-like sickness between January and September. They found unvaccinated adults, despite previously having coronavirus, were more than five times more likely to test positive for the virus than vaccinated people who had never had COVID before. So what they're saying is this. If you're unvaccinated but you had COVID before, you're still five times more likely to test positive for the virus than a vaccinated person who's never had COVID, meaning their infection didn't give them stronger protection from reinfection. As a matter of fact, it still pretty much sucks to be them. So it would make the argument of natural immunity pretty irrelevant in the entire story. In September, the CDC, this is the next paragraph, and in September, the CDC report found roughly one-third of people with COVID-19 in the study had no apparent natural immunity. So people that had COVID, who got COVID again, a third of them had no natural immunity. Recent studies show people. So is their argument that, well, they might have immunity, so you got to give them the benefit of the doubt, and sicken everyone else in the office? Sicken everyone else in the restaurant? Come on. The third paragraph from the, this is the second to last paragraph in the story. Recent studies show people with some of the highest levels of protection against COVID-19 are those who contract the virus and then get the vaccine. Final paragraph, the perfect system would be for where antibody testing is available to everyone, and that could be then used to drive clinical decisions on who has immunity, who doesn't. Without a robust antibody testing program, I don't think counting on natural immunity is risky. So basically saying, don't do it. So the last four paragraphs of the story basically are the story. So the story should actually read, Minnesota Republicans are turning to natural immunity, even though it's basically, non-existent or incredibly unreliable. You have to have the guts to call out and say something that's factual in the story. And that's not a political agenda. Although the Republicans will scream, you got a political agenda. Well, you got a political agenda because facts basically make their argument useless. Frustrating. It's frustrating because, the truth is that the problem here is, once again, is we shouldn't be trying to validate. We should not be trying to make stupid people feel good about their stupid choices. We shouldn't, especially when the stupid people's stupid choices jeopardize everyone else. It would seem to me that we would want to do the opposite of that, which is not encourage the stupid choices. And so by saying that, hey, these people think natural immunity is the way to go, even though natural immunity doesn't really exist in the manner that they are suggesting it does. That's factual, and it kind of blows their entire argument apart. But by basically coddling morons, we have gotten ourselves into this situation. It's time to tell these idiots to sit down, shut up, and let the adults talk, frankly. The other thing that got me thinking this weekend is something I want to pick up on, something that I've talked about a few times, and I talked about a little bit extensively on Friday's show. And what I want to do is share with you, there are sometimes I can tell I might be getting close to the truth on something when I see the reaction of the far right to what I'm saying. Now, a little bit of a recap. Sheriff Hutchinson should resign. He was drunk driving. He was driving 125 miles an hour. He made a lot of bad choices that evening. He should resign. No one here is arguing he should keep his job. He should resign. He sounds like he's got alcohol issues, mental health issues. I hope he gets the help he needs, but he probably shouldn't be the Hennepin County Sheriff anymore. No, not probably. He shouldn't be the Hennepin County Sheriff anymore. That being said, there was a story that broke at the end of last year and was covered earlier this month that basically a conservative journalist, Rebecca, who was the journalist that broke all the stories about Jennifer Carnahan and the Minnesota GOP, she got tips on the location of Hutch's crashed vehicle that he crashed while drinking and driving, and that it was being held in a Medina lot. And part of the people, by her own admission, part of the people that cued her into where this vehicle were law enforcement. Okay. So someone in law enforcement tips her off, hey, if you want to see Hutch's damaged vehicle, it's over here. But what was in the vehicle, which is the real question. Now, when the investigating officer photographed the vehicle, Eichens said, if there was anything mood-altering or that would have affected his judgment on driving, I would have photographed it, which would have made gummies. There were when Rebecca Brannon went to photograph the car, in the front seat, and what the implication is that she didn't move anything, that they were there prominently featured in the front seat of this vehicle, were weed gummies and a vaping device. That they were there. Now, Eichens says, I wasn't looking for them, but if they were prominently there on the front seat of the car, he says he would have photographed them. That's what he said. And this all comes from a Minnesota Reformer article I posted online. So there is a strong suggestion that the weed gummies and the vaping device were not in the vehicle when Eichens did his investigation, but yet were then in the vehicle when Rebecca Brannon went to photograph said vehicle in the Medina lot after being tipped off to the location of the vehicle by law enforcement in part. Now, once again, I am not of the mindset that Rebecca Brannon planted any evidence. I do not think so. I have read her stuff. She seems pretty straightforward. I am not, this is not about her. Although, once again, she did indeed say and admitted that there were a few things that she moved to take photographs of, but, you know, they're like business cards, but still, that was wrong. You really can't move anything if you want to not to disturb the crime scene. You move some stuff. And so at this point, anything in that vehicle is worthless anyway, because you had someone who was non-law enforcement poking around in it and moving things by her own accord. Now, once again, I do not think she did anything wrong. She's a journalist. She gets a call from law enforcement. Hey, do you want to go see Hutchins' vehicle? Sure, I'll go do it. I'll get an exclusive, which she did. Nor do I, once again, I want to be very clear. Of course, I do not think she planted anything. She seems like a very straightforward, you know, individual. I don't get the impression she has, you know, necessarily an agenda where she would plant evidence. That does not sound like Rebecca Brannon in any capacity. She seems very honest in the way she describes things. I disagree with her politics, but she seems to, there is nothing for me to question her integrity. So that leads me to the question, who then put the weed gummies and the vaping device in the car? Because they weren't there when Eichens investigated, but they were there when Rebecca Brannon then. And Rebecca Brannon was keyed off by law enforcement. Now, I've brought this point up a few times because that seems to imply, I mean, the larger implication here is pretty substantial, that law enforcement might have allowed themselves or non-law enforcement personnel into holding areas where vehicles are allegedly being held and evidence was being planted. And I gotta tell you, considering how many lawsuits involve vehicles, how many crimes and prosecutions involve vehicles, if all of a sudden we discovered someone was doing this and all of a sudden all these vehicles were suspect because you really couldn't say who or when someone might have gone into a vehicle, well, it pretty much could mean that you doomed a lot of cases, and a lot of cases might end up getting thrown out of court because the main piece of evidence, the vehicle used to prosecute that individual, has now become null and void because there was no guarantee that a police officer didn't possibly go into a vehicle and plant evidence. I'm just saying this is just taking what happened in this case with Hutch's car and going on a larger thing, because there does seem to be a question of worms and where, or not the gummy worms, the weed gummies and the vaping device, where did it come from? Because it didn't seem like it was there when Eichens photographed the vehicle, checked the vehicle. So there's a large implication. There has to be an investigation into this, not because I'm looking to get Hutch off the hook. No, Hutch needs to resign. Ta-da! Did you hear that, Republicans? Yes. Hutch needs to resign. But you can't have something like this. Because the implication is someone's planting evidence. And that's the case. Now, I'm going to take a break. When I come on back, I'm going to key you on one thing that tells me I might be on to something here. I'll tell you about that when I do return. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Reminder that we've got Native Roots Radio, I Am Awake, with Robert Pilot and crew coming up here at 6. Stay with us this evening. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. So sexy and free, something in the world. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. So I broke down the thing that there seems to be a question of whether or not weed gummies and a vaping device were planted in Hutch's vehicle and then a reporter welcomed to photograph them. I think it should be investigated for sure, because we're looking at the integrity of whether or not we can trust any vehicles that have been in a holding lot. Now, the reason why I think I've been keeping bringing this story up is because there's a tell I get when I know I'm on the right track. And that is when all of a sudden, out of the blue, I start getting attacked for a story by random people from all over the country who basically are saying, shut up, don't call about it, don't talk about that, shut up, don't say anything, shut up, you need to shut up, someone needs to shut him up. And we're like, what in the world, you know? And this story, I keep getting a lot of that, where how dare you even ask the question? Well, because it's a legit question. And the fact that there are so many people that seem for me to not want to talk about this story, this element of the story. They want to talk about Hutch. The only thing they want to talk about is Hutch. But they if I ask the question of, well, was evidence in the vehicle planted? How dare you? My guess is someone, I might not be wrong, that there might be a problem here. And someone is basically trying to vilify my asking the question as a way to dismiss it. Oh, yeah, you know me really well. Oh, I'm scared. I'm going to go run away now. Oh, screw you. Oh, you know, that's not how this works. You're basically giving me motivation now. So, yeah, I'm actually starting to wonder. It will be very interesting to see if anyone running for Hennepin County Sheriff doesn't, well, I mean, first of all, if I'm a journalist in this town, all right, when it comes to the race for Hennepin County Sheriff, a question that should be asked of everyone that's trying to challenge Hutch, if he hasn't resigned by that point, is, were you part of the law enforcement people, or you or anyone you know, part of to your knowledge, part of the group that informed Rebecca Brandon where that vehicle was? That should be a question that all these people should be asked on the record. Considering the Minnesota Reformer was the one that broke the story about the whereabouts in the vehicle and how kind of, you know, there seemed to be some questions about the evidence in the vehicle, it would also be very interesting to see if there's any Hennepin County Sheriff's candidates who refuse to talk to the Minnesota Reformer, specifically omit them from press releases or press briefings or something like that, or when they get asked to do an interview, refuse to do the interview with them. Because it's a legit question. And like I said, I would have probably let this thing die 3 weeks ago if not for the fact that a big tell for me is how upset Republicans get about me talking about a story. And if they get really upset, well, that tells me I might be onto something. Because every other time that I have caught this, it's ended up being absolutely true. So, now, I don't know where Hennepin County is, if they're doing an investigation. It would seem to me it'd be pretty easy, considering the nature of the vehicle, to see if there was any officers from any jurisdiction that wasn't Medina getting into the vehicle prior to Rebecca Brandon getting there, or if there was access to that vehicle that was unauthorized when it was in the actual holding lot. It would be pretty easy to track that down. But like I said, I'd be asking every Hennepin County sheriff's candidate, did you have anything to do with telling Rebecca Brandon where that vehicle was? Be interesting to see how they answer that one. Because like I said, the easiest thing is say no. If they say no comment. Hey, have a good one. We're back on a Tuesday. Till then, see ya.
Hi, I'm Scott Chambliot from Chambliot Family Dentistry. We're the fear-free, shame-free dental office. We know dental anxiety and dental phobia are real.